Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's September 12th, 2014. You're listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
And we'll see you at the tables. Oh, no way. I'm sorry. That's for the end of the show. I'm all discombobulated today. I don't know why. What's going on?
Hey, you're not the only one, man. I've been in a different hotel for the last 47 nights, it seems like. So, fortunately, tonight I'm in a gorgeous one here at the Ameristar East Chicago. It's a, you know, this room just opened up. The night before, however, I was in Travel Lodge.
Ooh.
And I'm going to publicly tell you that I'm no longer saving company money by staying at Travel Lodge. It's just not worth it.
Come on, it couldn't be as bad as the IP.
Yes, it could be.
It couldn't be as bad as that place in San Diego.
Yes. There's an entire drawer missing out of the dresser. Not even lying. And I didn't even notice it when I first checked in. I was telling my wife, you know, I got back from dinner and I brought some beer back because I told people I'm going to have to drink so I forget that I'm at a Travel Lodge. And she's like, well, how really, how bad can it be? And I'm like, I'm like, oh my gosh. There's a whole drawer missing.
That's
how bad. Laughed for the next 10 minutes. She's like, all right, I'm going to let you go. I'm like, all right.
Oh, man.
But anyhow, yes, I've been driving around like an idiot. Ohio, Michigan. I'm in Indiana now. And going to end this trip in Minnesota. And want to tell all of our listeners all the cool stuff that I found this trip. But we got too much else going on this week. So I guess we're just going to have to tease you. And you're going to have to come back next week to hear about all that stuff. Because Poker Hall of Fame nominees have been announced.
Yes. I'm starting to wonder if I can ever predict anything ever again, because I just don't know who to call on this one. You know, they always do their 10 nominees for the Hall of Fame, and they always announce who it's going to be right before the November 9. And, you know, they've got they brought some back from last year, but they've added some new ones this year. And the ones from last year, I thought, for shoe-ins were, you know, they weren't shoe-ins. So
right.
I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm gonna make my predictions after we read off the list, and I'm gonna be different than you, I think. I think I'm following you.
Yeah, I think this is good. That normally we kind of surprise each other, but we only want to put in the show notes, and I'm already looking at them, excited to have this conversation.
So. Yeah. So,
Yeah, well, go ahead. And,
well, the repeat nominees were Swedish superstar Chris Bjorn, Costa Rican superstar Umberto the Shark Brennus, high-stakes female superstar Jennifer Harmon, World Series of Poker champion superstar Huck Seed, Mike the superstar Big Mouth Matisau, and then Dan Negreanu in his first year of eligibility is on there. He's probably the biggest name of all of them. But he's awfully young, so we'll see. I don't know. Also, French ambassador Bruno Fitoussi, high-stakes hero Ted Forrest, Texas Road gambler Bob Hooks, and former WSOP tournament director Jack McClelland. So I'll let you kick it off, Scott. Who do you think is going to get in?
All right. Well, I got a ton of stuff to say, but I'm going to keep it short because I know you got your own opinions, and we'll go back and forth. Mm-hmm. I actually think this is kind of tough this year for me. So what I was kind of doing is I read through the little bios that the World Series sent out just to be sure I was completely up to date on what everybody's done. And I guess looking at that, I came down to Umberto Brennus. That's probably my only shoe-in. And then I'm thinking Hooks or McClellan for the other spot, because you can only get two. Remember, again, it's 10 nominees. All the people that are in the Hall of Fame right now and a media panel will vote. And one or two or zero, I guess, will be inducted during the November 9. So – and again, don't get me started on this whole limiting it to one or two. I think it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But this is kind of my thought process on it. You know, I'm not as familiar with Chris Bjorn as I should be, and after reading his bio, duly impressed. But then right after that, then you read Umberto Brenes's bio, and it's almost the same, except it's a different country.
Yeah.
And his stats are just slightly better than Chris's. He's got more World Series catches, more money. And so at that point, I don't know how you put Bjorn in over Brenes. So that's kind of where I got to Brenes. And then Fitoussi is probably about a similar, although more of an ambassador as well as a good player. So maybe any other year he would probably fit in. There's no question that Daniel Negreanu is going to be in there at some point, but I think it's way too early for him. I mean, he's younger than we are.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And then I think, you know, some of these other players are deserving as well. I mean, I guess where I was coming down on, and I know this is going to be part of what you're discussing, is it's what you consider a qualification to get in. Obviously, it's Poker Hall of Fame, so you would kind of default to play, right?
Yeah.
And if you default to play, obviously Ted Force, has got the most deepest resume of the players on here, so I certainly wouldn't be upset if he got in. But I guess more because I'm a magazine publisher, and that I kind of like the ambassadors of the game more than the players. So, and I'm sure other people kind of disagree with me. So that's kind of where my mindset is. But if we're looking at players, then obviously I think Ted Force deserves to be in on this list.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing about Ted Forrest is not only does he win on all disciplines, but he's been around a long time. He's part of that, you know, that cash game mix, too. I mean, I remember when they had the professor, the banker, and, you know, that book and all that. Right. They had those big things with the corporation, and Ted Forrest is part of that whole story, too, where he just all of a sudden sat down and started playing against these guys, and he wasn't even part of the corporation. And so, I mean, he's the kind of guy that can play the biggest stakes in the world. Has won consistently, you know, and that when I start thinking about, it's weird. It's who I think gets in or who I think is going to get in.
It's always kind of the Oscars thing, you know, when you read the paper the morning of it. It's always will win, should win.
yeah, exactly. Because, you know, when I think about most of the people that are voting for this, you know, like you said, it's hall members and then media panel. But the hall members, when you talk to them, and I've interviewed them before about this, you know, they start to say stuff like, well, you know, I've played with these guys. You know what I mean? I've been with these guys. I want to see them in the biggest cash games, and I want, you know, and that's what they're looking for, people who have done it in longevity. You know what I mean? That's what they're looking for, who play in the cash games that are, you know, world famous, that consistently beat the biggest cash games and who've been around, made a living at it. And then on top of it, titles too help. But I don't think a lot of the hall members give a lot of weight to tournament play. But if it's like spread across disciplines and it's been done through decades of time, where it's even now where it's harder to win, and back then when it was only the best were playing and then you're still beating them. So I think that Ted Forrest fits all of that. And I don't know. Not, this is his first time he's eligible, right? Or no?
No, I think he. Yeah. I guess it is his first time. Right. I don't know if it's first time eligible, first time on the ballot.
First time on the ballot. So to me, I mean, unless there's some sort of behind the scenes stuff that they would blacklist him for some reason, which I don't know of any of that. So I don't think there's anything like that. I don't see any reason why Ted Forrest wouldn't be the most deserving person all around on this. I mean. Yeah, he might not be like an ambassador to poker, but we all know who he is. And we remember when in the heyday when TV poker was everywhere, he was always on TV somewhere. So I'm going to go with Forrest that way as a player. And I don't know about an ambassador or not. I don't know anything about that. But
again, that's not a criteria. That's
yeah, no, I'm just saying if I'm going from all angles, I think that, you know, he covers a lot of ground there. And I think that he should be in. And then I think Harmon served her time on the, you know, as a nominee. I think that her time, like you said before, with Negron is too young, but obviously he's the best player of all of these people as far as longevity, you know, titles, player of the year. He's showing that not only did he play player of the year years and years ago in 2003 or 4 or whatever it was, but now again he's like player of the year. You know, I mean, it's just, he's just incredible. So, I mean, if first-year eligibility kind of things where they're like, all right, you'll get in, kid, but, you know, let's just get some other guys in first. If that's the way they're going, then I think, you know, she's served enough time where I think now she should be getting in. She's the most, you know, predominant female player in the world up until maybe a little while ago, you know. And she's got two titles that, you know, are out, you know, actually open titles. They're not just, you know, well, women's titles from the World Series. And she's played in the biggest cash game in the world for, what, 30 years or whatever it is, 20-something years or whatever? I mean, if they're, when you talk to these hall members, you know, and they say what they're looking for, she serves what they're looking for, and she's already had her time on the ballot. So those are the two that I think should get in. And if I had to pick a third, you know, McClellan is like a natural to get in because of all he did for the World Series and stuff. But a lot of these guys, they're, you know, they begrudgingly let people like that in. They're looking for, it seems to me, that every year the people who get in are the people who have made a difference in the game by playing it, not by just, you know, being administrator.
Well, I think you bring up a good point about McClellan, and it's the same thing with Hooks, I think, is that, you know, they're similar to other people that could be considered. I mean, like, you know, we have a lot of the Texas Road Gamblers are already in the hall, right?
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily know whether Hooks is Bob Hooks is any more deserving than the ones already in there, or if it's just one of those things where, you know, hey, you know, everybody, the older group, the old guard remembers all the people that were there at the beginning. So, you know, some of the people I trust, I was reading and they seem to be in favor of them. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. But you have to go back 40, 50 years to see his impact. And, I think that's the same with McClellan. I mean, there's lots of tournament directors out there, obviously. You know, so do you put all of them in just because they were a tournament director? I mean, Jack's been around quite a while, so he's probably in a different stratosphere, but that doesn't necessarily mean just because he's a tournament director that he should get in. So, whereas players, I mean, there's always a case to be made for the players, you know, because everybody's a different player. But let me ask you about Jen Harmon now, because I'm a mad fan of her, and I think she's a phenomenal player. You're right, she's played in the big game forever, which very few people have. But it seems to me she's on this list because if she wasn't a woman, she wouldn't be on this list right now. I think she would still make it on the list at some point, but it seems to be that's the reason. You know, because I'm looking at her stats. Obviously, she does a ton of charity stuff, which is great. Probably more charity stuff than other people do. But there's plenty of poker players that do real good charity work as well, too. I just don't see where that's at right now. I mean, I think, you know, you look at Ted Forrest, and I think is a more accomplished player than she is right now. I certainly think she deserves to get in at some point. I think it's still too early for me.
I hear what you're saying, and I think that she deserves that special consideration because of that. I understand what you're saying, but when you think about the odds against her, you know, the fact that when you look at a field and it's maybe 5% of a field is female, and then the odds of, you know, it's just the fact that she's had to put up with that and still comes through, you know, as successful as one of the best players in the world ever. But again, if you go back to what we were saying about what the players are looking for, I think there's a lot of weight in that cash game and in those high-stakes games that go a long way. But you're right. If you took her stats and measured them up against other people, there are tons of people who have way more victories. But again, it's like, look at Barbara Enright. I mean, what you know, she's got some stuff during her career. A lot of it is against, you know, she's a good player and she's a tough player and she played stud a lot and all that, and she's old school and everything. But really, if she was just a guy, she would not be, you know,
absolutely,
the person that she is. But because she made that final table, she's the only woman to ever make the final table, and you know, she's played for a living pretty much her whole life too. But you know, look at Marcia Wagoner. You compare the stats, and Wagoner just destroys her. But she's not even on this list.
Yeah, you know? And I think that kind of shows how this Hall of Fame has changed rapidly over the last couple of years, really. You know, because back when it was started, it was, you know, again, all those road gamblers at that point, I mean, Barbara Enright was just amazing for doing what she did, right?
Right.
And now you're this far forward in the future, and poker's exploded and went through this whole boom, and there's all kinds of players playing on TV and things like that. And, you know, I think if you were to throw everybody out of the Poker Hall of Fame that's in it now and restarted, lots of those players probably wouldn't make it in now.
Right. Absolutely right.
Including Wild Bill Hickok.
So it's a tough decision because it's really what the person is thinking about what the hall means and what that person means to poker. You know what I mean? So, I mean, the fact that she's in the Poker Hall of Fame, you know, that was, what, like 07, I think they put her in. And, you know, Barbara Enright, you know, okay, yeah, she's got a few bracelets, but, you know, I think one of them's open. The other ones were women's, and yeah, she's played poker her whole life, but so has Marcia Wagoner, you know what I mean? And back then, Wagoner's got a couple of stories where she's chopped the World Series bracelet because the bracelets didn't mean anything back then. She wanted the money, you know?
Right.
We even sat down and had dinner with her once, and she told us all that stuff. So it's like, you know, I mean, those people who are in the hall now, they know about Marcia Wagoner. They know how good she is, how good she was, how good she's always been. But she's not coming up on this list anymore because she doesn't have any bracelets. So she doesn't, you know. So Jennifer Harmon does have the bracelets. She does have the time and she does have the high game, the high stakes game. So, yeah, I understand what you're saying about the stats, but from a hall member standpoint, I think that they might look at her filing and say, you know what, she needs to get in because we need somebody in this hall that's a woman that is deserving of being in the hall and not just because she made the final table. You know, and played poker at stud, you know, and everything else for a while. I think if you put those two poker players together, I think that Jennifer Harmon is a much better player than Enright. And so Enright's in, but is she only in because she made the final table, or is she in because of deserving for, you know, and she's a woman, or because she's deserving? So I agree with you. I just think that Harmon deserves to be in if you're using that criteria from 07, you know. And the other thing is, a third person I would think that if Harmon doesn't get in, I think Huck Seed. I mean, how does he not get in? I mean, he's been on the list now for what? At least this has got to be at least his second time or third time that he's been on the roster.
Yeah, he wasn't on last year, but he was on the year before, and yeah. I don't know, earlier than that. But yeah, I mean, again, I think this is kind of the problem with you know, you want to keep it exclusive, you don't want to let 40 people in every year dilute it.
Right.
I also think you can let more than two in. but, you know, we have a lot of World Series champs, and obviously Huck is not just a World Series champ. He's shown that he's, you know, got staying power and can win in other things. But, you know, I think at this point now we're getting to the point where a lot of people look the same to me.
Yeah, it's tough.
And you have to figure out, you know, what makes you a little bit more special than somebody else. And I guess that's why I defaulted before to – it's much easier to see the difference that people make when off the table than it is the difference they make at the table these days. And that's probably the thing for Huck. He's a great guy. He's obviously World Series champion. He's done really well. But I think probably his problem is standing out among thousands of other players that are doing really well.
Yeah. Anyone else too, though? Then you take another look at the Hall of Fame and you think fame, famous, popular. Well, Mike the Mouth Matisau, he's got a ton of bracelets. He's made the World Series final table a couple of times. He's won the tournament champions. I mean, nobody is more famous on those than maybe Negreanu, maybe.
Yeah.
But I mean, really, everybody knows who Mike the Mouth is. Why? Because he has a mouth? Well, not only that, but because he's also backed it up. He does a lot for poker. He's part of the Deep Stacks team. You know what I mean? So, you know, a lot of people have a negative thing because of the way he talks, but anybody who knows him, you know what I mean? He's kind of like the Phil Hellmuth kind of thing, except for the blue collar guy, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
I don't know. It's such a weird, it's almost like they should just have like a rigid, here's what you have to have. If you have it, you're in the Hall of Fame. You know what I mean? It's not fair, but you know, if you think about it, you know, if you have X amount of bracelets, if you've played for a living for X amount of time, you know, you can't really do that but the human element really keeps the right people out too. And it's just, it's a tough thing. And that's probably why a lot of people think of these things as ridiculous. They don't even care, you know, because it's so subjective. And, you know, listen, you and I have made a case for just about everybody on the list. They should all be in. and right. It really should. Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, but you know, it's to limit it to two is kind of silly. I think. I mean, I know you want to make it special, but how hard is it to make it three? You know, or four? You know, I don't know.
Just add some more debates like we're having here. So I'll be curious to see what our listeners have to say about this. And, you know, choose an email, podcast@antiupmagazine.com, or send us a tweet or something like that. And maybe we'll get a conversation going on what everybody else thinks.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely a good tweet starter there. So,
but this was, I woke up to this a couple of days ago and instantly sad. I'm always instantly sad when a casino, especially one of the poker room, closes. But, where is the worm going to find his relaxation therapist now, Chris?
I know.
Taj Mahal.
That's sad.
The Atlantic City Casino, famously featured in Rounders, has announced that pending some unforeseen positive financial news, and unforeseen positive financial news has not come to any Atlantic City casinos this year,
no.
That it will be closing in November. And that's obviously the latest blow to the Atlantic City market. It'll be the sixth casino, I believe, to have closed in 2014 there. Not all of them with poker rooms, of course, but this one obviously used to be the biggest poker room in town, and now it's probably the third biggest. One, obviously, nostalgically sad to see this happen, if it does happen. But I'm going to say that I want to have a conversation about whether they should have embraced this Rounders thing a little bit more. I know this movie came out, what, 98?
Yeah.
So, you know, there are people driving now that were in the womb when right. this movie came out, right?
Right.
But this movie's got staying power, right? You can't talk to a poker player that doesn't know Rounders and probably doesn't like Rounders or even love Rounders, right? Some people actually watch it every night. I don't know how they do that. But, you know, when you and I went to the Taj Mahal the first time together, right?
Yeah.
And we're sitting there waiting for the manager to come out and on that sticky, gooey chair, right? We're
yeah.
looking up the wall and and they had a couple posters and things, but that was really it, right? I almost kind of felt like, now again, I know I'm a little weird. I mean, when I'm doing these business trips, I'm stopping at museums left and right because I just, you know, love that stuff. So maybe I'm a little weird, but I think they had a missed opportunity to really make that into a rounder shrine there and really get people in and, you know, I don't know. I just think they missed out on that. And I'm not saying that's the reason it closed. Obviously, this is a whole casino, not just a poker room. But but maybe that would have extended some time on the clock.
Yeah, you know, I completely agree that they – you know, here's the other thing, too, though. I mean, how long do you hang on to that? Because maybe they were doing stuff with it when we – you know, we didn't get into this seriously until – you know, into the magazine until – wait, we did the show until 05.
And I'll tell you, the Christmas Story House has got events the entire year long, and that movie was out before Rounders.
Yeah, I know, but
– so it's possible to – you know, I think you feed the beast, right? So, I mean, if they keep building on it, I think they could have really turned it into something. But
well, I remember when it was the 10-year anniversary or something of Rounders, and I thought they did something at the World Series for it or something, and it was like a bomb or something. So I don't know. I agree with you, though. I think that the poker room itself could have embraced it a little more and done more about it, and it might have made it, you know, more of a touristy thing, which get more people in there, gets more dead money in there, gets more people making trips or something because you want to see, you know, this is the table where he's sat, or, you know, they have a felt on, you know, something like that. I agree about that. I think the poker room definitely should have embraced it more, or at least kept it going, like you said, so that when we got there, it would have been like, well, this is the place to be, because this is where Rounders were shot, this is where they stood, you know, this is where he came in, you know, whatever, or something, some sort of whatever. I mean, obviously it's not big enough or important enough to do, like, tours and stuff. I mean, here's where they had noodles.
Hey, I don't know. There's a Seinfeld tour in New York.
That's
know,
true. That's true.
I mean, I don't know how you would have done it, and you know, I don't have a business plan for them here. But I almost, I mean, I probably would have bid on some of the movie props if they even existed. Maybe they didn't, because you know, Getting Rounders was pretty much a flop when it came out in the theaters,
yeah,
and it was
yeah.
in this underground cult classic afterwards. But you know, I would have had some props. Maybe I would have had like you know, an annual. You know, meet the cast. Obviously, you're not going to get Edward Norton and Matt Damon out there every year, but, you know, you get Knish maybe or
yeah, yeah.
somebody like that, and or Gretchen Mol, or just Gretchen Mol, would come out and do, you know, a meet and greet or something. I don't know, or a special rounders tournament. And maybe there's some kind of trademark stuff in that. But I got to think, you know, the rounders guys, the guys that wrote the movie, I mean, they certainly would have liked some publicity for, you know, that hogwash runner that we had to sit through, right?
Yeah.
So I'm sure they would have been, could have invited them out and did a big, you know, runner party with the rounders guy. And there's all kinds of things they probably could have done. And again, like I said, this is, it's a poker room in the middle of a huge casino in a market that's just getting crushed anyhow. So I'm not saying this is a savior, but I would have liked to see him do more of it.
Absolutely. You're right. I mean, there's no way it saves the Trump Taj Mahal. I mean, it's the casino that's shutting down, not. There's never been a poker room that saved the casino, but this is, you know, and I like the idea of a rounders tournament series or something. That'd have been kind of cool, yeah. You know. And they used to have the U.S. Poker Championships. Remember that? That was the whole Trump thing where he, you know, he liked having that tournament. That ran for a while. It ran right up until, you know, a few years ago. But it just, it's tough, man. It's a tough to survive up there, especially with all the new poker rooms opening. But yeah, you're right. I think they should have done more with rounders every year. They should have made like an annual thing or something. But again, if the U.S. Poker Championships didn't survive, I don't know if rounders would have survived every year either. So it's hard to say.
That's probably true.
But, you know, it's sad that they're closing. I mean, it is a shrine when you think about it. I mean, you think about rounders, think about it was the place to play poker on the East Coast for a long time. You know, people always think about, when they think about Jersey now, they think about Borgata, you know, but this was the place. This was the Mecca, you know, or whatever. I mean, they talk about it in the movie. I mean, and you either play at the Mirage in Vegas or you play at the Taj Mahal in Atlantic City, and that's it. You know, that was before Foxwoods was poker there. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So it's sad. It really is sad. And there's just no way they're going to stay open. It's just sad that they're going to close. And I mean, I don't know. Atlantic City might just end up being, you know, like Mississippi, you know what I mean? There's like three or four rooms soon, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, and I don't want to get off on a long tangent because we need to get moving on with the show.
Right,
but I think, you know, Atlantic City is going to end up being what Atlantic City should be in this current market. You know, the Borgata, as far as I can tell, is still doing fabulous business, and it's a gorgeous resort. And then you still got a couple other casinos still there in the boardwalk, and that's what it can support. I mean, I don't think we're going to lose too many more there. You know, it's really kind of where we're going is most places are, there's, you know, one or two casinos now. You know, you don't have these big blocks of them outside of Vegas anymore. Because people don't, casino gambling is not a tourist thing anymore. You know, it's something you do if you're on vacation, but you don't do what Fast and I used to do, is pick a place to go every year and hop on a plane and go play poker. It just, you don't do it anymore because there's so many casinos close to your house. So, and that's really why people went to Atlantic City. I kept telling people, you know, no one likes to go to Atlantic City, but when that's where you got to go to play poker, that's where you go. So, but you know, Borgata's gonna be fine, I think, and the couple of surviving ones will be fine. But you know, the market is gonna be what the market should be there now.
Yeah,
all right, well, it's time for us to build up our bench of possible anti-up ambassadors. We haven't asked our listeners to apply for quite a while. We might even be looking for a starter or two in Louisiana, Missouri, and other parts as well, too. So even Canada, which I was in this week as well, too. I'll talk about that next week, too. But if you'd like to be one of our monthly columnists and represent Anti-Up in your home area, please go to antiupmagazine.com/ambassadors and apply.
Hey, you know, each week we spotlight a listener who called our hotline at 206-338-6344 or emailed us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we'll do a Call to Floor and Hand of the Week, we send them something fantastic. This week's sponsor is J-Design Playing Cards, the official playing cards of Anti-Up. Check out J-Design's great cards and more at classicplayingcards.com. This comes from Nigel, and I'm very happy he called in. Because one, we like hotline calls. We don't get them that often anymore. And two, because it's right in our wheelhouse. So here we go, Nigel.
Hi there, Chris and Scott. This is Nigel Taylor calling from London, England. I was going to try saying, this is a test, this is a test. But I don't think I sound enough like Scott to get away with it. I'm a long-time listener. I picked up your podcast when you were about 4 months in, and I've been following it ever since. But I'm a first-time caller. Anyway, I'm a micro stakes player online, 1 cent, 2 cent cash, and tournaments under a dollar, which I enjoy a lot. I also play in a local pub league, and I've been to the local casino and played a couple of 30-pound tournaments. That's $45 for you guys. Anyway, I'm going to be in Vegas for a few days in October, and I decided I wanted to try a few tournaments, maybe up to a $100 buy-in, and maybe a cash game or two, $1, $2, I guess. I looked up poker rooms and tournaments in Vegas online, and there's a huge amount of choice. I hoped maybe you Vegas veterans could give me some advice on where you would recommend that I play for tournament or cash. And also, maybe Scott will be able to give me some advice on bargains in Vegas. It's a great show. Keep up the good work. Cheers.
I'm really, really stoked because the timing of this couldn't have been any better.
Very good timing, isn't it?
Yeah, if there's anybody out there who has a finger on the pulse of Vegas tournaments, it would be our ambassador, Rob Solomon. You know, he's one of the content guys for Poker Atlas and, you know, allvegaspoker.com. And he wrote a column for our September issue on Poker Stands Now. About the best 7 o'clock tournaments in Vegas.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like exactly when you would go to there and exactly when you'd play. You spend the day, you know, doing whatever you want to do in Vegas, seeing the sights, whatever. And then when you want to hunker down after dinner and have a nice poker tournament, there you go, man. He's listed them all. I mean, it's not even, you know, it's not even close to anybody who would know better than him. And he's told you everything in our column. And if you don't obviously get a copy of our magazine in London, you can totally go to antiupmagazine.com and our online flippy thing, as we like to call it. You can see the actual article, or you can read the story online, too. We've loaded it up both ways. So you can read everything that he has to say about it in our current issue. And it's pretty extensive, I think, to me. I mean, I love reading his column every month because you always know that you're going to get the best stuff that's going on in that area, whether it's recaps or previews or whatever. But in this case, he really breaks down the tournaments, and it's definitely worth the read.
Yeah, so it's a very great, very good column, and it's great for the 7 o'clock. I guess what I would say also to Nigel is obviously the morning tournaments are a little bit different. There's a lot of shove fest, I like to call them, 30, 40-hour tournaments, which, you know, I'm not being negative about it. You just got to know what you're getting when you get into it. You know, short chips, short blind levels, below buy-in and high rakes. But they could be a lot of fun. You know, Bash and I used to play those all the time.
Yeah.
And other players enjoy them. So that's kind of what you're going to find in the morning. I think the best value, though, really is the 7 o'clock time frame, you know, because you get anywhere from 60 up to 200 buck tournaments, depending where you want to play. And most of them have pretty good structures. So nighttime is really the time to play the tournaments, but in the morning, it's you want a little shove fest to wake up with. There's lots of casinos that do those. Just understand what you're getting yourself into.
No, exactly.
But also, they're thinking you're going to make it the day two because they're barely even an hour or two.
Yeah, the 7 o'clock, there is such a variety. It's crazy how many rooms offer that 7 o'clock tournament. And like you said, the buy-ins are all reasonable. Basically, they're, you know, between 60 and 200, and there are some different types too. There's survivor types, there's regular types, there's freeze outs, whatever. I mean, so, you know, it's plentiful, and he breaks it down really well in our column this month. So make sure you take a look at that, antiupmagazine.com.
And then Nigel did mention deals, so just a quick plug for two websites that have absolutely nothing to do with Antiup. They've just been tremendous resources for me over the years. Definitely LasVegasAdvisor.com. That's the famous coupon book that you always hear me talk about.
Right.
I think it's $40 or something like that. If you're going to be in town for more than 2 days, you're going to make that money back instantly, and you probably even make it back in 1 day, depending on what you like to do. And they also have a treasure trove of information on the site as well, too, if you don't want to do the coupon book. And then CheapoVegas.com is another site that I've always loved. Don't be turned off by the name. It's not necessarily about cheap things to do. They do good reviews of every hotel, no matter, you know, they're $400 a night or $10 a night, and all the gambling and eating you can do with them. And they do a really good writing style as well, too. So check out those two things for the deals.
Absolutely. All right, find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and not sure what the prop ruling should have been? Email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and we'll have Antiup Poker Tour Tournament Director Sam Minatello tell you how he would have ruled. This comes from Jay Grimes. He says, this scenario is more about the actions of the floor rather than the call he made. In a cash game in a local casino, Action was heads up between the end of the gun and the button, who had his opponent covered. On the river, the button declares he's all in before any action from his opponent. His opponent asked to know what would happen if he checked or bet. The dealer properly called a four and said that because the hand was still in play, he could not answer the question because it could adversely affect the button. I've been told by a few different dealers that this was the right course of action. I just cannot reconcile how the explanation of a rule would unfairly affect the hand. The sad truth is that I have seen a variety of rules interpreted differently at different casinos and, worse, differently at the same casino. So first, was this the correct response from the floor? And second, if it is correct, please explain why the clarification of a rule would have been wrong.
Sam says, the floor was correct in his actions. We can all agree that the button was incorrect by acting out of turn on the river. However, his out-of-turn action doesn't allow the other player in the hand to have the option of how he wants to play against the out-of-turn action. If the floor explains to the under-the-gun player what will happen based upon how he plays his hand, then he has multiple options now and can make his decision with bias. Our job as the floor is to make the fairest ruling without persuading or forcing another player to make actions that could affect the outcome of the hand. A player in the first position needs to decide his own action based upon how he wants to play his or her hand, and then the floor will notify the players as to how the button is to continue on with the action of the hand. Now, I like this ruling. I know you don't, so this is going to be fun.
Well, it's not that I don't like the ruling. I just think that there are times where you can phrase the question differently and you would have gotten a different answer. And I think you might have gotten a different answer from Sam.
True.
And
yep.
So for me, there have been a million times where you're at the table and they call the floor over, and because it looks innocent enough, they'll explain everything and talk to you for an hour about things. But in this situation, they're saying that you're going to get the benefit of something when, to me, the other guy made a mistake, and now he's getting the benefit of something, and he should be getting that benefit. So I think that the playing field should be leveled here. If I didn't know what the rule was, why did I call the floor over? Because I didn't know what the rule was. I want to know what the rule is when someone bets out of turn. To me, I should be able to have that rule explained to me. Now,
well, he did. He said, you know, you're going to have to act first, and then the player will be able to act. I mean, it's not the ruling that,
right,
not
so
the explanation that you want, or I believe Jay Grimes wanted, or probably this player wanted, but they did issue a ruling.
Right. In other words, he's saying he can't tell you what will happen if you check, and he can't tell you what will happen if you bet. But what if he's asking the rule, when someone bets out a turn and someone bets ahead of them, does that bet have to stay? You know what I mean? You're asking about a rule, but because during the hand, they won't tell you the real rule. They're telling you what you have to do, and then what basically is, we can't tell you what to do. And I just feel like, I don't know. To me, it feels like this guy is getting screwed because someone else made an angle shoot and bet out of turn. And so this guy doesn't get to have the level of playing field.
Again, I understand why people would feel the way you do. So, and this is where these call the floors kind of get pretty contentious. What I will remind players is that, you know, they're responsible for knowing the rules. And I think if you play poker long enough, you know that an out of turn action is not binding, is binding unless there's a change in action. So, so if you are the under the gun player and you want the button to go all in, then you check.
Right.
And he's going to be compelled to go all in, and you should know that as a matter-of-fact rule. Now, I know everybody else is saying, well, why can't the floor just tell you that? Well, it's because probably the button may know that rule, and you don't, and that's, you know, that's part of poker. And if you do know that rule and you don't want him to necessarily go all in, then you can make a bet, and then he obviously can change his action, which doesn't mean he's not going to go all in, but... I get why people think that the button has the advantage because they acted out of turn and now the other player's not getting the answer he wanted. But really, by acting out of turn, that button had put himself at a disadvantage, you know, if he didn't really want to go all in. So now you've got to play that second level, third level, all this crap that we normally have to play at poker and try to figure out whether he meant to do it, whether it was an angle shoot, if he really didn't know that you checked or whatever, you know. So I honestly get what Sam is saying is once you go and explain a rule to somebody that doesn't know. I mean, it sounds really weird, I know, but it's the same thing as in the middle of a hand, someone saying, hey, is ace, two, three, four, five a straight? And if the floor said, yes, it is, he's obviously affecting the action, right? Because as a poker player, you should know what a straight is,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And that's really kind of the same thing here. And now I know, you know, you can't, a poker player, you can't be expected to know 4,000 different rules. And Jay Grimes makes an excellent case here that just because you know the rules doesn't mean that they're going to be interpreted correctly at the casino you're in, or even the same as the floor yesterday ruled the same one. So that's what's frustrating. But that's a frustration that's different than this situation. That's a frustration with poker floors in general, or that room management in general. And what I guess I would say is it's tough to say, you know, if you end up losing $200 on this hand or something, is really what you need to do after the hand is go to the floor and say, hey, yesterday you ruled this way, today you ruled this way, what did I miss? And if they said, oops, sorry, we made a mistake, well, let them know that you're not happy that they made a mistake and they need to do better because you're paying them a rake, and then they need to be. But you can't solve everything in this one the situation. I mean, a lot of the stuff has to happen afterwards. And this is a tournament, obviously, that this player potentially might have got a penalty. I doubt it, but it's possible. It's a cash game, so it's a little different. But, I mean, obviously, I think the floor should have, once they explained the action, reminded the player not to bet out of turn. And if he's going to continue to do it, that he needs to go home and shower for the night.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say, too. So I'm glad you said that. Not only was there a ruling here, but there should have been a warning, too, that, you know, you can't keep doing this or you're going home at least. So this guy at least gets some sort of, you know, reprimand for angle shooting if he did angle shoot, you know?
Exactly. So, you know, it's like all these things. It's a tough decision, and the floor's job is not to make it worse. And I understand why players think that if they explain it, it's not making it worse, but technically, it does make it worse to interject your opinion, or let this player know what's going to happen.
And like I said,
you got to play your own game. So, I mean, and that's what I do at a table. If somebody's playing out of action or out of turn, then I'm going to ignore that. I'm going to play my hand the way it should be. And it gets back to what Sam was saying, you know, the last couple weeks, too. You know, we can't win hands on technicalities. You got to win with cards.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing here. You got to play your game the way you should, not whether somebody made a mistake or is angle shooting. You play your game the way you should be, and then let the cards speak.
And I don't, like I said, I don't disagree with this ruling. What I'm saying, I just think that there is always, it just depends on the way you ask it or the way it's phrased or whatever. Sometimes you'll get different responses from the floor depending on what you say to them.
Yeah,
first.
And you're right. Maybe a better way of saying it is, hey, I understand that you may not be able to tell me, but I want to let you know that I played in this room last week and this was the ruling, and I played in this room yesterday and this was the ruling, and they're different, and I need to have some clarity on how this room does it. You might still not be able to get the answer, but at least you've made a compelling case for why you need to know that answer.
That's exactly right, because when you went back to your universal truth of is ace, deuce, tray, 4-5 a straight, that is a universal. You can't change that anywhere. But this can be interpreted. That's why I think that this guy should have been told what the rule is on betting, because there have been a billion other call the floors where there was a question about betting and the floor came over and told him what the rule is on betting. You know, if he put his money in front of the thing and then brought it back, whatever, he'd say, well, the rule is you can't do that, but I know it's going to affect someone's action, but there are still people that left to act after that. So this is sort of the same kind of thing. This is an interpretive rule, not a universal rule. So I still think that this guy could have been told that without it. If the other person's going to go out of turn, he should have known the rule, that you're not supposed to bet out of turn. So because he broke a rule, the other guy should get some leeway to learn the rule. That's all I'm saying. And I'm not saying what his ruling was wrong, but to me it just feels like the other guy got an advantage by getting away with doing something he wasn't supposed to do.
Yeah.
Whether he did it right or wrong, didn't know. If he didn't,
I
have
no
problem
with people believing that, just so they understand why the floor rules.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely right. So, like I said, I don't disagree with Sam's ruling. I'm just saying that I felt like there's a way to have phrased this when the floor came over that you could have gotten your answer, and it wouldn't have been, I don't know. I don't know if it would have been right or wrong, but I mean, I'm just saying it just felt like this poor guy got put in a situation, and it's an interpretive rule that he's heard of being done differently in different places. So he wants to know what this place is going to do, and that's all he's looking for. He's not looking to, you know, screw the button. He's just.
It also depends on what your hand is too. I mean, you gotta figure out. You know what you're going to do with your hand for the most part, right? So right. It's almost like you got to do the little Men in Black laser thing, you know? That's what they're trying to do here. Is let's just forget that this guy said that he was going all in. And if you forget that he said he was going to go all in, you're going to play your hand the way you want to play it. And obviously, you don't have the little, you know, laser thing to technically do that. But that's what you're trying to do. And, you know, you got to make your bet off based off of that. And again, really, it goes back to that first, second level thinking. You know, if that guy thinks that, I mean, really, he's at a disadvantage now, because if he was, unless he has a strong hand, wants you to call us all in. He's at a disadvantage now because he's really on the hook for betting all in if you check.
Right.
So if I have a monster now, I'm just going to check and let him commit his entire stack, right?
Yeah.
So really, he's the one at ultimately at the disadvantage. He only has an advantage if you let him have the advantage based on that angle shoot.
Well, one thing that we don't have to worry about there being any kind of interpretation of is that we are going to finish an O'Malley's move today. Always a good thing when we can finish off an O'Malley's move and learn something from it. So let's refresh our memories with part one.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week we are seated in a $1, $2, no-limit hold'em cash game. The table is a little short at seven-handed, and there are two maniacs. We are most certainly the best player at this table. The blinds post, and we look down at the ace of spades, ace of clubs, under the gun. We make our standard raise to $8 and watch the action get folded around to the cutoff who calls. This is one of the maniacs, and he currently sits with 250. We've got him covered with 400. The blinds fold, and we go to a flop. The 8 of hearts, 8 of diamonds, 6 of diamonds falls. Since we were the pre-flop aggressor, we put out a bet of $12 into 16. The maniac calls. The turn is the 6 of hearts, putting two pair on the board. We make perhaps our first mistake and check. And with $40 in the pot, our opponent makes a $15 bet. $15? What's the move?
Oh, all right. I think this is one of those things that illustrates the problem of being out of position, right?
Yes.
So we check, so we technically give up control of the hand, right?
Right.
Now this guy bets. So it could be anything from a boat trying to get early value to complete air seizing on our check. And obviously this is a very scary board, right?
Right.
It seems unlikely to me that he has a boat here. And even if I'm wrong, it's going to cost me $15 here to get a look at another card to improve outboat him. And even if we don't, then, it's $15 to buy that extra card. And maybe we may not face a difficult decision on the river. So to me, this is an easy call.
Yes, there's no reason to raise here in my mind. Even though I feel like we're still ahead, like you said, I don't think this guy's boated. I think we're ahead. But if you raise for some reason and then he decides to come over the top, now, you know, you could have gotten away with seeing it for 15 and then maybe a moderate bet on the end. So if there is a moderate bet on the end, I'm going to call now, see the river, and call the moderate bet. And it really feels like a defensive bet for some reason. I don't know why. It feels like he's kind of like, you're not really interested in this, even though you raised pre-flop, you had ace-king, I'm going to represent that I have something. And it doesn't feel like we're behind here. So I'm going to call the bet, and then if it's a decent bet, I'm going to check the river, and unless I improve, and then sure. See what happens. So we'll see what happens.
Hello again. What could this be? It does kind of seem like a call-me bet. Or it could be some kind of draw, and he's just trying to do a little blocking. Whatever it is, he's piqued our curiosity, and we call. The river is the jack of diamonds, and with $55 in the pot, he makes the same $15 bet. Okay, we're probably beat here, but we're just too curious and just have too big of a stack to fold. We make the call, and our opponent turns over the 10 of hearts, 9 of hearts? Okay. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying, learn how to play against maniacs. You'll save yourself a lot of money and a lot of heartache. This one was just downright weird. I hope to see you on the felt.
Well, thank goodness for players who don't know how to run a bluff, right?
Yeah, they're there every once in a while.
Oh, man. I mean, a substantial, though not crazy bet probably could have gotten us off his hand, and we were already a little bit perplexed on the turn bet, right?
Yeah.
The fact that he kept a 15, we're like, we have to get in. So almost like he was reeling us in, and then another 15. And again, it almost feels like he's trying to reel us in, but if he's trying to reel us in, I'm almost like a fish. I'm on a hook. I'm like, all right, well, if it's only $15, I'll take the chance that you're going to put me in the boat and play me tonight.
Yeah, that is an absolute poor bet on the end. I mean, we called 15. No, we're not going to not call 15 again, you know. He'd have to put us on a very specific draw and then put us on a very specific thought process that we were behind and there's no way we could win and that he's defensive betting or value betting thin. I mean, it's absolutely the worst bet he could have made. He should have just checked and then said, hey, I can't win, or gone way more, exactly. Like 50 or something, you know, but 15, he just, yeah. I mean, I can see him calling preflop with that hand. It's a great hand to call with preflop. But even the bet on the, you know, if you're going to bet, 15 is probably not enough anyway the first time out on the flop to try to steal this. You know, he's betting, what is it, a gut shot, right? I mean, yeah, the opponent was pretty weak in this.
Yeah, I'll tell you, though, I mean, we'll talk more about the play that I've seen on this trip next week, but this tournament I played two nights ago, there were people calling off their stacks with gut shots I've never seen in my life. calling off, not even, like, bluffing. Unfortunately, I think there are more of these players out there than we might want to admit. I don't know if O'Malley plays in Michigan, but there seems to be a lot of them up here in Michigan.
Man, are you sure you're not in a Dominican Republic?
Yeah, exactly. Dominican Republic is a good spot too. So, but yeah, if you're gonna run that bluff there, you gotta make that $45-$50 there.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're not comfortable making that bet, which it sounds like this guy wasn't. Then don't make a bet at all. Just you know. I mean, this guy made a mistake right away on that turn betting or calling that $12 into that pot of 16 with a gut shot with a scary board. You know. And he just compounded by these tiny, stupid bets, like little annoying gnat bets.
Yep, absolutely.
All right, it's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or sisterway shits to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. That's probably the most excited you've been for the Hand of the Week all the time.
I'm always excited for Hand of the Week. I just, you can't see my face.
All right, well, we'll see if we can take care of that because this is Pot Limit Omaha 8.
Boo! All right, quickly, send me the hand and I'll read it to you. Oh, peel away.
It comes from our old friend Brian Cole, who's a big guru on the forums. And again, it's an old school hand, so he's still playing online.
Man.
It's from a $1 or $2 sit and go. He couldn't quite remember. But again, it's Pot Limit Omaha 8. It's in level 5, but all 9 players are still remaining, and our hero is down to 1070 in chips. I'm going to assume this is a standard 1500 chip tournament.
Yeah.
Lost about a third of his stack here. And the two villains in this hand have him covered. So okay. Now he's got this his goofy graphical hand history thing, so it's not as easy to follow along, so I'm going to be slow like Forrest Gump. So I don't mess anything up here.
All right.
Level 5. It's the level is blinds are 6120 at this point. So he's got a little less than 10 big blinds,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
He's got 1070, right? And he is in the small blind. And let's see, we got 1, 2, 3 callers before it gets to him. In the small blind, and he has tray of diamonds, tray of hearts, 5 of diamonds, 8 of hearts. So a pair of trays, weak low draw, and double suited. What do you do?
Fold.
Yes, right?
I'm sorry, but the small blind is not worth defending with this hand. If you were one spot over on the button, you'd probably fold this hand. And if you were under the gun, you'd fold this hand. Just because you have to pay, you know, another 60 to see it and have 1,000 chips left over, I'm sorry, I fold the hand. This is not a good hand. You're not making a nut anything here, unless you make quad threes. You could make a steel wheel, but you're literally looking for ace-deuce on this flop. And everyone who plays a hand has ace-deuce in their hand, generally, in this level. So, I mean, I'm. What am I looking for here? You know, if I make the heart flush, it's going to be an 8-high heart flush. If I make a diamond flush, unless it's the steel wheel or a straight flush, we're making a 5-high flush, essentially. I just, and the low, it's going to be difficult to make this low because any live deuce and whatever, you know what I mean? So I really am folding this hand, so I can't be held accountable for any further than this. There's no way I play this hand. I just muck it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad this is our good friend Brian that sent it in, because he's not going to take offense to us just trashing him from his hand.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is you gotta have to put four guns in my head for me to put more money in the pot with this hand. And I understand why people do, because you had what the three callers, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of money in the pot, and it's Omaha, so you see all these possibilities. But I think you're right. If you take a minute to go through and look at all those possibilities, all of them are crap possibilities. I mean, you're really hoping for, as you said, quad trays or an unlikely low or steel wheel.
Yeah.
Think about those things. That's like, two Powerball tickets and a Mega Millions hidden. It's just really not worth it. And then what I factor in is the fact that, you know, I'm down to what I said, less than 10 big blinds, right?
Yeah.
10-7. I'm not good on the math, so I'm going to quickly do the calculator. Bear with me.
Mm-hmm. Well, while you're doing that, the other thing too is
8.91 big blinds.
Yeah.
So I mean,
and you don't want to flop a set either. You know what I mean? People might say, "Oh, I'll flop a set of three. It's terrible."
Yeah, it's going to be, other than there's no way it's the best set.
Right.
There's no flop that can come where it's going to be the best set, and that's always the key in Omaha, and particularly Omaha 8, because at that point, because if you hit that. If you hit your set, that means there's a low card out there that's probably going to help somebody else as well too, right?
Exactly.
So, I mean, I got 9 big blinds here. I'm going to hold on to these chips and use them to my advantage. Every chip is 20,000 times more valuable now than it was before at this point. And throwing 60 in here, it's almost like the R. O'Malley's move. That's 15 bucks that I got through in the end, completely wasted. And no ability to do anything for the hand. 60 we're going to throw in here, has absolutely no ability to do anything for this hand. And it's going to put us in peril, because obviously it's a hand of the week, so we know something's going to happen here. And we don't want anything. There's only three things we want to happen here, and it's very unlikely that any of them are going to happen.
Right. And the other thing, too, is unless you make a wheel, you're essentially playing for half the pot already, because you're not going to scoop unless you make a wheel. So, and then if a wheel comes out, where you're making a wheel, generally someone else is probably making a wheel too, because they're probably playing ace deuce tray, or they might make a full house on you with their ace deuce. If it comes ace deuce, then you make your four, and then a deuce comes out, so you can still not get. There's just so many ways for this to go wrong, rather than so many ways for it to go right. That's the thing, is the more cards you get, the tighter you're supposed to play, not the looser, especially in a split pot game, because you're only playing for a half if you can't scoop. You can scoop with a three and a five, you can make a wheel, but you have to have very specific cards coming out. Again, let's not play the Powerball when we're playing a tournament here. Let's play quality. So, and we're not ripping on Brian, we're just saying, for lessons, for people to learn, this is the kind of thing that you don't play.
Right. Okay, well, he makes the call, big blind checks, and we see a flop of 9 of hearts, ace of hearts, king of clubs. Obviously, we're first to act with absolutely nothing.
No, we have an 8-high flush draw. We have a backdoor wheel draw. We've not paired any of our cards. So basically, we have a pair of threes against what looks to be 16 other cards in play. I check.
Yeah, this is I think this is a wonderful flop for us, because it makes it so easy to realize, slap our face and go, why did I even put that 60 in?
Yes.
I can get out.
Yes.
Very easily. I suspect what's going to happen is that we were lured in by this hard draw. And that would be most unfortunate. But we decided to check, and actually, it's not the hard draw Lures is in. It checks around. Imagine that.
Yeah, and back of my mind, I thought the only way we're going to go further in this hand is if it checks around. That was what I was thinking about, because if somebody makes a bet of 200, there's no way we're sticking around, you know, or 400 or whatever. So, yeah, that's terrible, because now you know what's coming. You know, either a heart or another.
Well, yeah, and I think it's even more terrible now is now not only does it give us another card, which people get excited about, well, now maybe I've got a chance. No, you don't. But the worst thing is there's no way that this flop didn't hit someone, right?
Right.
Ace, a king, and two hearts. I mean, somebody had something here, so I'm wondering why no one bet. I mean, I guess maybe everybody's got low draws and you don't want to bet your low, but somebody's got to have something here, right?
Yeah.
And maybe it's something big, too, and they just know they got six people in, so they want somebody to catch up. It's kind of my guess, but all right, we'll see what happens. All right, so the turn is the, wait for it, tray of clubs. So now we hit our baby set, and we are first act.
Oh, man. Well, now you're not going to get people to fold because now you got two to a wheel out there, and you're going to have people out there with, like, well, 4-5 or 4-3, you know, the other case 3 or something, or 4-deuce, I mean. So, I mean, you knew that was coming.
Really, even lesser lows would call here. I mean, even in a bigger game, but particularly in a dollar sit and go, I mean, people will hang on to any kind of low at this point because they see the ace tray and they figure, yeah, no one plays deuce 4, so their deuce 7 is probably going to be good for the low or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah.
So you gotta be mindful that there's players like that out there.
See, the problem, like you said, is somebody could easily have a set of nines here, or have, you know, a set of kings here, or even a set of aces. You know, not everybody raises because they have aces in this game, because PLO 8, you know. I don't know what to do here. I think I might put out a feeler bet, but like you said, I have like 8.5 blinds left, you know, and it's PLO, so I can't go all in. And what's in the pot? We had 5 players to the flop with 120 as the big blind, so $600 in the pot?
$600 in the pot.
Oh, man. Yeah, I can't bet pot because I'm not going to, you know what I mean? There's just no way, and I'm not going to bet. If you bet a little bit, I'm just going to check.
Yeah. No, I think that's the only play. It really is. I mean, again, you know, this is what we teach in the Omaha class, you know, unless you have top set, don't get excited about your set.
Yeah.
And we have 4th best set right here. It's probably a little less likely that there are aces or kings out there just because with that many people on the flop, somebody would have bet to protect, I would think. But the nines are very likely, and nines are something that somebody would check there because, again, it's not the top one. Plus, you got the hearts. I mean, I think somebody would say, hey, well, I got a heart redraw. No, you don't. You got to redraw it at 8 high. I mean, I guess you could still garbage win it, but it's not anything I'm confident about committing half my stack, which is really a legitimate bet here, right? It's half your stack.
Right.
And really, this is one of these things where I'm just going to check and hold on tight and hope it checks around again, and I get the showdown really cheap, and everybody's going to be like, you turn over your trays, and everybody's like, oh, he's checking the monster over there. You know, that stupid little funny thing people do.
Yeah.
And then I'll scoop in the pot, but I am not confident at all about this. Because now there's a second flush draw out there, too.
Yes.
So you're not going to give me away. So if you had more chips, it would make more sense to make a bet here and hope that you get the low draws, the heart draws, and the club draws to put money in now because they won't put it on the river if they miss, right? And hope they all miss. But we don't have the chips to do that, I don't think, at this point. So,
and really, hold on. Here's another thing, too. What card could come on the river that you didn't lose 50% of this pot to?
Very good point. Yep.
Right. I mean, unless it pairs the board and you make a boat, but even then you can't be happy. But if anything that doesn't pair the board comes on here, they're making Broadway or they're making a low. Because if it's a nine, you make a boat, it pairs the board. But if any unpairing card, right, 10 comes, Broadway's there. Anything higher, Broadway's there.
That's
anything
an
lower
point.
Is a low. So, I mean, you're screwed no matter what you do. So why bet? Because you're not going
to
lose
anybody. Down to the case tray is the only card you really want to see come.
Right. The case tray is the only card you want. That is so sad.
Yeah.
I can't bet here.
Yeah. All right. Well, it wouldn't be hand of the week if we checked. So our hero bets 400, which if you're going to make a bet, that's probably the decent bet. But again, it's almost half our remaining stack.
Yeah,
so we're at this point, we're committed here. So really, at this point, I guess if you're a committee, you might as well bet the whole pot, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, too. You know what I mean? You can't fold. If somebody came over the top now, would you fold? I mean, if you wouldn't fold, then why not just bet pot and try to scare everybody at least? But you,
yeah, even at this point, if you fold, you've got less than 5 big blinds left, so you're committed at this point. So.
Yeah, and if people say pot, sometimes it scares people. When you say pot, they just freak out and just fold. They don't even think about what's in the pot or what the bet was. So I would just say pot if I'm going
to
bet.
Well, and here's the other thing to think of. Yeah, absolutely. And here's the other thing to think about, too, is what I talked about before, is that, you know, there's a case to be made for getting value from hard draws, club draws, and low draws before the river crushes everybody's hopes and dreams, right?
Mm.
So if that's the case, then might as well bet the whole 600, right? Get as much value as you possibly can, and, you know, maybe you scare those people out of the pot, and you win the pot, and, hey, at this point, that's a pretty big pot for our hand, right?
Yeah.
I'm betting the max I can, and hope either I take it down or I get people to overcommit on weaker hands. And then hope for the miracle river card, which we know is truly, truly a miracle.
Yep.
All right. So we get two callers of our remaining four opponents. So we're three-handed to the river, which is the 10 of diamonds. So our final board, 9 of hearts, ace of hearts, king of clubs, tray of clubs, 10 of diamonds. So all of the cards that come, it's probably one of the better ones, right? Because the flush draws didn't get there. Obviously, the backdoor Broadway got there. And the lows didn't get there either. So probably after the trade that we were looking for, it's probably the best card to come. Still not confident with his hand, though.
Yeah, because Queen Jack is clearly could be somebody's hand if they had Ace, Deuce, Queen Jack, and there was double suited or something like that. Queen Jack is definitely a hand that somebody could have with four cards, so we don't like it, but like you said, it could be the hand that's least likely made right now as a Broadway. So, but I'm not betting. I mean, if I had 400 and I put it in, I only had 600 left, you know, I might as well just check and see if I can get away and keep the 600, because if somebody bets it, I'm not folding anyway. Yeah. But calling is not going to get anybody to fold.
No value in betting.
Yeah. Because Broadway is going to bet anyway, and if they have Broadway, they're going to... So, I mean, you're only going to get called by a better hand anyway, I think. So, why bet?
All right. Well, our hero decides to shove. So, puts his last 550 in. And the next player to act shoves over top of him and gets the remaining player out. And that player shows King of Hearts, Deuce of Clubs, Jack of Spades, 5 of Clubs.
What?
I am not incorrect on that saying there. So we win 2,900 with bottom set.
What? Wait, can you tell me what he had again? King, Jack, what?
King of Hearts, Deuce of Clubs, Jack of Spades, 5 of Clubs. So at this point, I guess he's in hoping for the low to get there. Obviously, didn't get there, and he literally has, am I reading this correctly, a pair of kings with a jack kicker?
Yeah, he has a pair of kings with a jack kicker, and he had the wheel drawn a turn, but to reshove with a pair of kings and Broadway out there.
Now, I will say this. Obviously, it's a $1, $2, so these players may have absolutely no clue. I will say there are times that I have not called off all my chips or shoved all my chips, but made a bet and limit where I honestly thought on this board that I had the low. It is because my mind, I'm thinking, oh, hey, I've got 2-5, and then that card comes, and they're like, and I had a king, so I'm like, you know, hey, if I 2-pair or something, but I didn't get that, well, at least I still have the low. So it can happen. It shouldn't. But wow, this is probably the most fortunate hand in the history of Omaha 8.
Wow, to win this pot is like he should have gone out and played the Powerball. Because, I mean, the guy obviously had a legitimate call on the turn. He had a pair of kings with a wheel draw and a backdoor club draw. So, I mean, he might have gone away if someone bet pot on the flop. But since nobody bet, he gets to see the turn for free. Now he's picked up essentially a wheel draw and a flush draw and still has a pair of kings to work for him. But it's the river that I don't get.
Yeah.
All he has is a pair of kings, and he reshoves over our 550. That's the thing I don't get. But whatever. We got lucky, and that's huge that he won that hand. I can't believe that he won that hand. And I can't believe that... Oh, man, I can't believe that he shoved, too, in the end. I mean, I guess you shoved because, you know, what the hell, you only got 550, but to get the reshove, that's hilarious. The reshove with kings. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it had to be either a misclick or a misread.
Man, I didn't know my parents played online poker.
But even if I had deuce 5, I don't think I would be that excited about my low, right?
No, because
it's probably going to win, but it's not enough for me to commit those remaining chips. I mean, I'll call a 550, and if I'm wrong, I still have my 475.
Yeah, because
deuce 4. If I'm even going to do that, though.
I mean, he could be the guy that you were talking about before where they're saying deuce 4 isn't probably going to be out there. So.
Right, exactly.
But
wow. But again, even then, it's only half the pot. It's only half. Think his king is good for the high. I mean, you're only going to win... You might win the high, you might win the low with that hand. Let's assume the low was out there, wasn't a 10. Let's assume the low is like an 8 or something. Wow. The best you can hope for is winning half the pot. You don't know which half, but half. So,
wow. So that's got to be why he sent it in, too, because how shocking that ending was is worth,
truly shocking.
Worth the price of admission, even though the price of admission is free. All right, don't forget, tune in next week for Scott's Midwest and North of the Border Report. We're looking forward to that. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the table.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.